passage that will drive what we're going to talk about in our time together this morning. As many of you are aware, the past several weeks, the elders, as we are going through this process of selecting new and more deacons for the congregation, have had a window of opportunity to submit questions that you would like answered in writing. And that window closed this past week, and so the elders had set aside this Sunday morning to talk about the questions received and the concerns and questions that you had. And so that's what we're doing this morning, is addressing those and taking a look at what was submitted and the questions that were raised. But as we get into things this morning, let me tell you how glad I am to see you. I've been taking a lot of vacation here this summer, and so I am glad to be back with you. I am especially appreciative to the good number of men who have filled the pulpit in my absence. I appreciate so very much your efforts on my behalf. You had to do more work so I could do less, and I do appreciate that. And I know that the congregation has benefited from the good words that have been spoken. One of the great blessings we have here in this congregation is that we have a number of men who are very good Bible students and good preachers in their own right. I know that you've enjoyed and been benefited from them as well, and I am thankful that they gave me the opportunity to take a little time off, especially with our having a baby here in the past month, and that was a nice break for me, and so I am thankful for that. Also, just one other little bit of housekeeping business. 2 weeks from today, that's going to be August the 17th, 2 weeks from today, Brent Moody and his family will be with us. You may recall that a few months ago we announced that we had asked Brent Moody and his wife Katie and their two children, Chelsea and Titus, to join us here in the work here at Kleinwood. And the time for their move is at hand, and they will be with us. Their first Sunday with us will be 2 weeks from today. And so you can be looking forward to welcoming them as they join us in our work here. I know that they're excited to be here, and Brent's enthusiastic. And so we'll look forward to their joining in our work of God in this place. If you're visiting here with us this morning, one last thing, and that's to welcome you. We're especially glad that you are here. We appreciate your presence, the encouragement it brings to us. We certainly hope that this service is an encouragement to you as well, and whoever you are and however you found your way to us this morning. We certainly hope that if anything that we do here or that we talk about creates questions in your mind, things you want to know more about, study with us about, rest assured we'd be happy to do that. And you just need to say something to somebody before you leave this morning, or if you'd rather leave a visitor's card behind, and tell us a little bit more about yourself and your questions and how we can get back in touch with you, we'd be happy to do that as well. But we are glad that you are here this morning. All right, well, hopefully by now you found 1 Timothy chapter 3. Let's start in verse 8. Deacons likewise must be dignified, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. They must hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience, and let them also be tested first, and then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. Their wives likewise must be dignified, not slanderers, but sober-minded, faithful in all things. Let deacons each be the husband of one wife, managing their children and their own households well. For those who serve well as deacons gain a good understanding for themselves and also great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. And there we have in Paul's letter to Timothy the qualifications, the expectations of what sets a man apart as being qualified to serve in the church as a deacon. Now, back in June, we spent a couple of Sundays unpacking this text as being the key text that talks in the Bible about what deacons are and what they're to be. And so we've already spent a couple of weeks, a couple of sermons, going through these qualifications. But as is almost always the case, there are more questions that could be asked. And so this morning, we're going to wade into and look at the questions that have been raised, things that have been left unsaid perhaps so far, or things that just need some clarification for your benefit as we go through this process of appointing deacons here in this congregation. And so what I've done this morning is I've basically, having had the questions filtered through the elders to me, what I've done is I've boiled or condensed the questions that have been raised in the four areas, because they really deal with four aspects of the deacon and his work. And so we're going to talk about the questions under four headings this morning, the first of which has to do with a deacon's children. Let's start from the text itself. The text says of the deacon's children, there in verse 12, they need to manage their children and their own households well. Now, when we talked about this passage in the past, the things that we emphasized from this passage, number one, is that the most basic stewardship for a man is how he raises the children in his household. The most basic stewardship, the most basic realm of responsibility, the most basic act of service in the sense that a man has is as a father, of how he handles the young people that God in his providence has entrusted through birth into his household and into his care. A deacon, of course, is simply a servant. Deacon, there's nothing special about that word. It's an actual common word in the New Testament used in a lot of non-technical senses or times. We just talk about somebody who is a servant. This is deacon with a capital D here. Somebody has to be set aside as a formal servant in the congregation for specific public works. And so one of the most basic things you're looking for, the man who's going to be publicly entrusted with responsibility to make sure certain things are done in the congregation, that the congregation is served in certain specific ways, is that he be a responsible man, that he take things that matter seriously. And one of the best ways to see that is, how does he handle the responsibility that's already been entrusted to him? What kind of father is he? Does he shepherd his children well? The most basic stewardship for a man is how he raises his own children. If he does not take this responsibility seriously and do it well, he's probably not going to be very committed to do anything else that matters that the church might entrust him with as a deacon. And so he is to shepherd or to guide or to manage his children well or beautifully. In other words, he's not just average, he's not just so-so. He takes it seriously, and it's very clear that he is an active, involved, capable father of his children. Now, questions that arise about this qualification go in a couple different directions. Questions have been asked have to do with how old should the children be? And do the children of a deacon who are of age, that is, they've reached a certain level of maturity, a certain number of years, do they need to be Christians? Do they need to be Christians? So here's the thing. In this text, the focus is on the deacon, not on his children. The deacon is the subject of the verb. How he manages his children is the issue. How he does fatherhood and shepherds his family. The emphasis seems to be in the text on how well he meets his family responsibilities. The deacon is the subject and the children are the object in that sentence. It is only in the qualifications for elders, which precede this paragraph that we're reading from in 1 Timothy 3 this morning. Back at the beginning of 1 Timothy chapter 3, it's only in the qualifications for elders that the role of an elder in shepherding people relationally towards spiritual maturity is viewed in terms of how his children specifically have turned out. Are they in subjection? Are they faithful in Titus chapter 1? It's only the actual condition of the children themselves that only shows up on the qualifications for elders. Now, here's the thing. That makes sense. That makes sense on one level, because what a deacon does and what an elder does are two different things. As we talked about in previous sermons, elder or deacons are not junior elders. They're a work that stands alone in its own right. Deacons are to be men who are to be trustworthy, blameless, or responsible for meeting certain needs and doing certain works. We're looking for responsibility and capability. The qualification for an elder at the end of the day is one who is given spiritual oversight of a congregation. Are they apt to teach and are they able to lead people towards maturity? When it comes to an elder, it makes a lot more sense to look at how his children have turned out, especially as they've gotten older, because we want to see if a man is capable of leading people to maturity over time. But that's not necessarily the role or work of a deacon. We're looking for a man who keeps his responsibilities. There's one other consideration as well. Whereas elders, and the qualifications for elders, we are told to look explicitly at how their children have turned out. Versus deacons, we're just looking at how the man does the work of fatherhood in and of itself. The very term elder itself implies an older man, somebody who's in a different stage of life, somebody who's got children who are probably old enough that we can see the outcome of their parenting. There is no inherent age expectation in even the word deacon, a servant. They only need to be old enough to be married and to have some children. That's the only thing that's inherent in the qualification. An elder, by definition, is somebody who is of age and life experience, marital experience, and parenting experience, and we want to look and see how things have turned out in their own home. But the deacon just needs to be somebody simply who is capable of sustaining responsibility well. They are not junior elders. They are not necessarily, and as an explicit part of their work, necessarily tasked with the work of spiritually maturing people. They are tasked with the work of meeting needs and doing the work of service. So the fact that elders are necessarily at a later life stage, they ought to have children that are old enough to see the outcome of their spiritual training. But the text on deacons makes no such claim. Now, let's not go too far the other direction. Let me say this and hear me well on this. Obviously, the behavior of a potential deacon's children could very well raise questions about how faithful he is to his fatherly responsibility. But the text itself places the emphasis on the man, not the children. I may very well be able to tell if a man is faithful to his responsibilities of a father, even if his children are not yet at the age of accountability, even if they're relatively young. I can still tell an awful lot about somebody and the kind of father they are, even if their kids are only 5 or 6. I can already tell if their children understand authority. I can already tell if their children love God. I can already tell if their children have a moral compass. I can tell an awful lot about somebody and how seriously they're doing their work of fatherhood, even if their children are not yet at the age of accountability. And so here's the thing, and we've talked about this before, but let me reiterate this again. We, brethren, need to learn to be able to make qualitative judgments about people. We typically focus on the easy, the objective things. We want cut and dried lines. Husband of one wife. Does he have children who are Christians? We obviously can judge somebody by the open and obvious sins that they may be guilty of. They're a drunkard or a fornicator or something like that. But in our culture, we've been shaped by our culture. And in our culture, when you can't quantify something, when you cannot objectify something, when it's not a simple yes or no, we have a hard time evaluating and making wise judgments anymore. That's why, especially, again, we've talked about this before, but those of you who work in the corporate world, that's why everything's driven by policy. We have policies for everything. You know why we have so many policies in the world anymore? Because we can't trust each other to make good judgments. And people sue each other and litigate each other. Policies are a protection against litigation from bad judgment. That's the world we live in anymore. And the policy mentality has gotten in the church where we are afraid or we are hesitant to simply make good judgment calls anymore. And so that's why we want everything reduced to black and white sometimes. The temptation is we want everything reduced to black and white, clear, distinct lines, yes or no. And especially going beyond the policy mentality of the world that we live in, we also live in a very tolerant age that has made us shy to expect great character. We are afraid of being tabbed judgmental. We are often afraid to expect seriousness and substance and maturity because these things have become so rare in the world and sometimes even in the church that we don't want to make anybody feel bad, which is the worst sin in our culture in this day and age, is to make anybody feel bad about themselves. Or we don't want to have to admit that we are not what we should be or what we could be in this area. And so we become afraid to insist that a deacon really be raising his children well and not just the average. We're uncomfortable, perhaps, because to have those expectations of somebody else reminds us that I myself have not done this in my own home, either presently or maybe in the past when I had the chance. The men selected need to be standard bearers, examples of love, faithfulness, commitment, effectiveness in their own homes. And we need to be willing to make judgments, not out of judgmentalism, not out of self-righteousness, but because God has called us to seek out those who meet his standards, who can then serve us in deed and an example. And so at the end of the day, no, the text is not required. There's nothing in the text that requires a deacon's children to be Christians or even be old enough. But it does say that we look at how the man is doing the job, how well he is doing a job as a father. And that requires making a judgment call, yes. Sometimes it's clearer than others. But is the man shepherding well his house and his children? That's what the text says. And that's the standard that we are called to. That's the standard that we're called to use. Not to add it or try to quantify it or make it simpler or just a simple yes or no. Does the man, and it's a very clear adverb in the text, does he do it well? That's a judgment call. But that's what the text says. Also related to the issue of the deacon's children is, of course, of how many children does a deacon need to have? The answer to this is the same that we gave when we talked about the qualifications for elders. Children is simply a generic term that concisely indicates one or more. I know sometimes people say that and say, well, it's plural, but yes, it is plural. But think about how we even talk in common everyday language. If I only had one child, and somebody came up to me, if a police officer, in fact, came up to me, or I were under oath in a courtroom in a legal setting, and I were asked, Mr. Wilson, do you have children? And I only had one. If I said no, you know what? I've now perjured myself. Because just generic, the way we use the language in the culture, to simply say children is just simply to say, are you a parent? Do you have children, one or more? The emphasis in the text is not upon how many. Now, sometimes some folks have wrestled with this, and they'll sit there and say, well, listen, there's a big difference in having one child versus having two or more children. That's true. But let's think about that logic for a moment. It only gets us so far. Yes, it's different to have two children than just have one children. But I will tell you, the greatest gap is between no children and having children. That's the far greater gap, and any of us who have had children recognize that. My life changed when my second child was born. But my life really changed. My life really changed to the greatest degree when the first one came. That's when life really changed. Because I'm always a parent from that point on, whether I have one, whether I have two, whether I have three, or however many. The implicit logic sometimes of trying to argue or suggest that a man who has two children, well, having two, it's a little more complicated, he's more qualified. Well, there's something to that, but then how do you draw the line? Does that mean a man with five children is automatically more qualified than the guy who's only got two? Because last I checked, most congregations have a lot more than two or three people. Where is the end of the line of logic? Or if we're going to think in those kind of terms, then the logic would also demand, does it mean then that a man who has a number of children of mixed gender, boys and girls, is more qualified than somebody who only, say, has three sons or three daughters? Because after all, any of us who have both boys and girls recognize there's a world of difference in raising boys and raising girls. The logic then of, well, they're more qualified if they have multiple children, it begins to fall down if we begin to push what's implicit in that idea all the way out. Then it means that people who don't have mixed genders in their children aren't as qualified because they're lacking certain experiences. And they lack no more experience because they don't have mixed genders in the household than they do because they don't have as many children as somebody else does. The biggest difference in life is children and no children. Not the number of children. That the degree of difference exists between becoming a parent or not being a parent. Everything else is just a gradation of degree after that. And so the number of children is not the issue in the text. The issue is he a father? Is he somebody who is responsible for a family? And by the same token, sometimes the question is raised, do the children have to be the man's own or can they be adopted? The issue of children has to do more with how well a deacon fulfills his responsibility towards those he's responsible for. The distinction between children by nature, biology, and children by choice, that is, those who have been adopted, is not relevant to the purposes of the qualification that the man rules or shepherds his children in his household well. Whether they came into his house by nature or by choice, if they're his sphere of responsibility, he's accountable for them. And however he got his children, it does not change the fact that he is a father, legally and morally. Somebody who has adopted children could not stand before God in the last day and say, God, you can only hold me accountable for my biological children, not for my adopted children. That wouldn't work in the last day of judgment. It doesn't work this side of eternity either. If a man has children in his household, whether they're biological or by choice, the issue is what does he do with them? How well does he shepherd them and care for them and manage them? And that seems to be the issue. And so we're talking about issues and questions that can arise about a deacon's children. We now move on to talk a little bit about the issue of a man's marriage, being the husband of one wife. Literally in Greek, the text just says the phrase just is a one-woman man. A one-woman man is what he's described as. And so especially questions that usually come up in this regard have to do with, does the man have to be married only once? Or can he be, say, a widower who remarries and enters into a second marriage that way? Or perhaps somebody who's been scripturally divorced and remarried? Where does the husband of one wife come into play with those kind of life circumstances where you're dealing with somebody who's a widower who remarries or somebody scripturally divorced and remarried? So here's the thing. This issue is the same basically for elders or deacons because both of them in this regard are described the exact same way. Both elders and deacons are described as a one-woman man. The literal phrase, one woman man, simply serves to exclude both bachelors, because by definition, somebody who's never been married is not a one woman man. To exclude bachelors, and also to exclude polygamists and adulterers, somebody who is a more than one woman man. Somebody who has experience. What God is looking for is somebody who has experience in marriage and has followed God's marriage law. But where the rubber really meets the road, what about somebody who's in a second marriage, either because of death of the first spouse or because of scriptural divorce or remarriage? Part of how we may answer this, part of what may help us answer this, is to actually turn the page to chapter 5. And I want you to look at something with me in chapter 5. Because this phrase, with the genders reversed, shows up in chapter 5 and verse 9. In chapter 5, Paul is giving out the qualifications for a widow, for a woman to be put on the roll, to be put on the list for the church's benevolent aid. A lot of us don't often even realize this, but there are actually qualifications. There are conditions, God-given conditions, for a widow to be assisted by the church benevolently in an ongoing manner. In the list of the qualifications and expectations for a woman, for a widow, to be placed upon the list, Paul says that she needs to be, the widow needs to be a, and it's literally just the changing of the genders, but it's the exact same phrase in Greek, a one-man woman. The widow must be a one-man woman. Well, here's an interesting thing about a widow. Number one, by definition, if she's a widow, and that's what the text calls her, she's a widow, by definition, her husband's already dead. And yet she can still be considered a one-man woman. But she's already dead. But her husband's already dead. He's already passed on. That's the whole point. That's why we're even having this conversation in chapter 5. Let the widow be enrolled, Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 5, if she's not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. By definition, a widow's husband is dead, yet she's still called a one-man woman. So here's the thing. Do you think that what Paul means by this is that if her first husband died when she was 36 years old and she remarried only to have her second husband die when she was 61, she would be ineligible for the church's benevolence because she's technically had two husbands over the course of her life? Is what Paul trying to say here that if she's a one-man woman, that she's only had literally one marriage partner her entire life, and so even though she was a young widow once upon a time, she could not have remarried, and even if her second husband died, she would never be eligible then for the church's assistance if she were a widow indeed over the age of 60 now. Well, that doesn't make sense, because in fact, if anything, it means later on in chapter 5, when Paul is giving the advice to young widows that he desires them to remarry, that's actually horrible advice, because it means if they ever find themselves destitute in old age, they won't be eligible for the church's help. What does it mean to be a one-man woman? It means somebody who's lived by God's marriage law. That's what Paul's saying. Not literally that you only could have had the one spouse. She could have remarried in younger age. Her second husband dies. And now she's of age and needs the church's assistance, having perhaps no children to support her in her old age, which would be also one of the qualifications. But Paul makes no sense in giving advice to younger widows to remarry if what he's actually encouraging them to do is cut themselves off from any scriptural claim to the church's support in old age if they ever need it. That's horrible advice. You've already had your chance. Your husband has died. You're a young widow. Tragic, yes, but don't get remarried because you'll never be eligible for benevolent assistance. That's not what Paul's getting at. The issue is this somebody who has lived by God's marriage law? There's no reason to interpret this as disqualifying a widow because she had what amounts to, listen, two scriptural marriages over the course of her life. Now, here's where it gets interesting. If it's a scriptural marriage because her first husband dies and she remarries, is it no less a scriptural marriage because perhaps her first husband committed adultery against her, she divorced him for a cause and remarried? If it's a scriptural marriage, it's a scriptural marriage. And so a man who takes a second wife, going back to deacons, because of scriptural divorce and remarriage, is no different than the man who takes a second wife because of his first wife's death in terms of this qualification. He is still a one-woman man. He is still living by God's marriage law. Now, prudence, judgment, we're back to this issue again because we often want to make everything so cut and dry and simple. We just want simple yes or no's. Prudence would require a case-by-case scrutiny of the circumstances of a man who is divorced and remarried. But that's a matter of judgment, not a matter of a legal limit from the biblical text. You understand what I'm saying this morning? It's a matter of judgment and discretion. Is a man scripturally remarried or not? And I need to say this as well, that we always need to remember to interpret these qualifications in light of their purpose. The purpose of these qualifications is not some sort of legal technicality. We're looking for men who have shown in the course of their life that they are capable of keeping responsibility. That in the case of elders, for instance, they are capable of leading toward maturity. These are not arbitrary things given by God for the purpose of catching people in technicality so they can't do work in the church. What God is basically looking for is men who show in the course of their life that they respect His law, they live by His law, and that they are responsible and active in doing so. We need to always remember to interpret these qualifications in the light of their purpose. Is he a father and does he do it well? Is he a married man and does he live by God's marriage law in his marriage? Is he a one-woman man? And that seems to be the issue. Third area that questions were raised about has to do with deacons and the nature of their accountability. Who exactly are deacons accountable to? Are they accountable to the elders? Are they accountable to the congregation? Who exactly are deacons accountable to? Well, in one sense, ultimately, deacons are accountable to God. That's who they're accountable to. If you're worried about the deacons getting away with something, listen, like all the rest of us, every man at the end of the day stands accountable towards God. They are fundamentally accountable towards God because God's the one who establishes the role and the work in the church in the first place. They're accountable to God first and foremost. But in human terms, and on this side of eternity, deacons would be most directly responsible to the elders as to the ones who direct deacons in their work. Here's the thing. The only clear instances of the terminology of deacon being used, of diakonos, of deacon being used in the technical sense of somebody serving formally and officially in the church, in a congregation. And the only passage, which is really just Philippians 1 and 1 Timothy chapter 3, in those passages, deacons only and always appear in the larger context of elders being present. In other words, you don't see an example in the church of deacons being present without elders or without some other explicit form of leadership. And so, for instance, Philippians 1 and verse 1, Paul and Timothy, servants of Christ Jesus, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are in Philippi, with the overseers or the elders, the overseers and the deacons. And likewise, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, in the larger context here, Paul doesn't talk about deacons until he's first talked about elders. Because if a church is going to get it right, you start with elders, you start with the God-given official leadership of the church. And it's only after you have people in place who can direct the deacons that you then worry about having deacons. And so in both of these instances, the only real two clear, explicit examples of deacon being used in a technical sense in the New Testament, it's always in the context of elders. Because deacons are ultimately a means by which the elders can carry out certain facets of their work and, as the apostles once put it back in Acts chapter 6, not be distracted by material needs so they can worry about the work that they need to be doing, the spiritual work that they need to be doing. There are other legitimate needs that need to be taken care of in the church, but it's not the best use of the elders' time, talent, and ability to minister to material needs or to more administrative affairs. And deacons are a means by which elders carry out their work. And so deacons are most directly responsible then to the elders as the ones who direct the deacons in their work. Now, as deacons serve among the congregation, there is a certain natural responsibility of the congregation. They are selected from among the congregation. They are members of the congregation. They serve and work for the congregation. But accountability in the sense of formal authority is between the elders and the deacons. The members of the congregation are not empowered to micromanage the deacons as though they're just here to do customer service for us or something like that. And so sometimes the question comes up then, well, what do you do when deacons say they aren't living up to what they agree to do? Maybe they're not fulfilling their role, their work. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Whose responsibility is it then to hold them accountable? Well, ultimately, it's the elders' responsibility because they're the ones who direct the deacons. It is the elders' responsibility to hold the deacons' feet to the fire, and if somebody's not fulfilling their role, their responsibility, the elders ultimately are charged with confronting the man over that. But here's the thing. If members are aware of deacons who are not fulfilling their publicly known duties, the spirit of the church, the spirit of Christianity, the spirit of Matthew 18 would encourage us as individual members to privately encourage a deacon to fulfill their responsibilities, and failing to resolve our concerns that way to take the issue to the elders. We are our brother's keeper, after all, and that doesn't change just because somebody is a deacon. We just need to be careful to avoid an adversarial posture. We're not trying to catch failures as much as we need to try to help people grow in maturity and service. We need to be careful in the church, and this is true not just of deacons, but just true in general, even of how we approach the elders, preachers, of how we approach each other. We need to be careful of avoiding the customer service mentality that we have with other groups in the world that we deal with, where instead of supportively working to fix a problem at a restaurant, we just usually ask to speak to the manager. We just try to basically call somebody out for the trouble that they caused, the failures that they're guilty of, rather than trying to constructively. I mean, listen, let's be honest, and I include myself in this. Any of you ever tried to coach up the waiter who's not getting it right? No. We just ask to speak to the manager. We just call them out on it. And the church is composed of different people of a different spirit trying to live a different kind of life in a different kind of community. It's not about asking to speak to the manager. You see somebody failing in any sense in life, my job is not to catch them or play gotcha or try to get them in trouble. My job is to try to help them live up to what they're supposed to be and what they need to be doing. And I will tell you this from just life experience as well, and most of you know this already and know it well. A lot of times you see somebody who's struggling or maybe somebody who's even failing. Don't assume you know the whole story until you talk to them. Sometimes there are circumstances that you and I may not know about. There may be reasons that somebody has maybe been struggling to keep up with their duties lately. And I just assume the worst. They're a slacker. They're irresponsible. They just want the title. They don't want to do the work. I just assume the worst. Maybe there's been a death in the family. Maybe there are hard things going on at work. Maybe this is just a season that they're in that will pass. I need to show them the mercy that I would want somebody to show me if the roles were reversed. Our job, ultimately, in the church, again, whether it's talking about deacons specifically or just talking about each other, whether it's sin or whether it's anything else, our job is not to try to catch each other and get each other in trouble, as it were. Our job is to encourage each other and help each other and push each other. You see a deacon struggling in his work, maybe examine the circumstances. Maybe there's more to the story than you realize. Maybe what that deacon needs is just a word of encouragement because he's tired. Because the work is hard. And again, let's be honest, most of us are more quick to complain when something goes wrong than to praise when things go well. And serving takes a toll. It's a lot of work. And so we always need to avoid the temptation to gossip or to grumbling rather than working constructively to help someone successfully in their service to God. Now, all that being said, maybe somebody really is a slacker. Maybe somebody really has just coveted the position for the title or for the appearance and not because they were serious or because they remain committed to the work. Well, you talk to them. And if that doesn't work, at the end of the day, it is the elder's role to hold deacons accountable. But shouldn't deacons, someone may say, shouldn't deacons, especially because they're deacons, strive to do what they say even more? Is it just an office that they hold? Well, of course they need to strive to do their best that they can. But if you've ever had a bad day, a bad week, a bad month at work, allow your brother or sister in Christ the same level of humanity and weakness. And to be sure, as is mentioned in an earlier sermon, a deacon is not an office in the sense of an honorary title position that we give to men for superficial reasons. Maybe because they're socially popular in the congregation or because they've been a long-term member and it's just due to recognize them in some way. And so here, you've been here 20 years. Good for you. Be a deacon. It's a work to be done, a role that needs to be fulfilled. Choosing deacons is as serious as choosing elders. We just often don't look at it that way. That's why Paul in this passage talks about letting these men be tested first, examining them. Because God doesn't look at the work of deacon, again, as being a junior elder, as that men who are appointed deacons are getting second-rate consolation prizes or something insignificant compared to other works in the church. To be a deacon is not a second place or consolation prize for a man who's not an elder. And this is not a popularity contest for men who are well-liked socially in the church. This is not a reward for long-time membership in the congregation or generosity in giving. It is more than just an office. But at the end of the day, we look out amongst ourselves, we choose from among ourselves. They are responsible to us in the sense that they serve among us, and we are our brother's keeper. But it is not our place to micromanage them. It is the elder's place, formally and with authority, to hold them accountable. And fourthly and finally, fourthly and finally this morning, talk a little bit about questions that have been raised about the process of appointment itself. The process of appointment itself. I've been gone so much, I'm not sure how much the elders have already explicitly talked about this or not, but we will be using a percentage system again to determine men who have a consensus of the congregation support to serve as deacons. And so, just answering that, my understanding is that we will be using a percentage again to choose whose names are put forth and whose names are acceptable to the congregation as a whole, who gets a consensus of congregational support. But the question is asked, where's the authority for doing it in this way? Where do we get the authority to do it this way? And that's a good question, not just for this work itself, but even just as a quick review over how we find authority for anything that we do in the church. When it comes to using just a percentage of the congregation, that men are going to be appointed deacons, need to have a certain percentage of support from the congregation, it's just an expedient method for determining elders and deacons among us. In the Bible, we have a general authority to appoint elders and deacons. And in the Bible, when there is general authority to do something, with no further specific instructions from God as to how to do something, then we are permitted to determine the most expedient way to fulfill that general command, as long as we don't violate any other scriptural principles in so doing. Now, let me give you a quick example of the difference between a general concept versus expedient means of fulfilling it with something that some of you are familiar with and maybe some of you never even thought about before. Let's talk about the church building for a minute. There is no church building in the New Testament. I don't know if you've ever noticed that or not, thought about that or not, but there are no examples in the New Testament of congregations owning a piece of property with a building on it. It didn't happen. So why do we do it? We do it because we believe we have general authority to do so. In the New Testament, God clearly expects congregations to assemble regularly on the first day of the week. We are clearly expected to assemble. To assemble requires a place to do so. But in the example of the New Testament, even though there's no example of a New Testament congregation owning a building or land, in the New Testament, we find churches meeting not in some specific singular way, as if there's only one way to do so. God gave no specific instructions to churches about the one single way in which they are to gather and assemble together, the one place or means to do so. As the New Testament, we find congregations gathering in public places like the Jerusalem church and the temple precincts, which is kind of like the Jerusalem version of a public park, at least parts of it. And so they would gather in a public place, a public forum, a public space that was there to do it. And that's where the Jerusalem church met at times. Other churches met in private homes. We see that in the New Testament. Paul will even talk about, for instance, Philemon and the church that is in his house. Other congregations met out in nature somewhere. We find in the book of Acts, Paul being a group of women who had gone out to pray by a river, and that's where they assembled. That was their place of assembly. There was no single way that God commanded. This is the way and the only way that the church is to assemble. God just said, you are to assemble on the first day of the week, and left us to our best discretion, given our cultural circumstances, time and place that we may live, the best and most expedient way to meet that general command. And so, in our time and place, our elders, and for most of us, most of the congregation that we've been familiar with in our travels and in the different places that we've lived over the years of our lives, most congregations in our time and place, in our country, in our culture, deem the actual owning of a property and building as the most expedient way to provide a place to regularly assemble. And that's a great example of a general command that the church is to assemble regularly, with God leaving it open to us to finding expedient ways to do so short of violating any other command of Scripture. So bringing it back to the question at hand about the process of appointing deacons, no, there's no example in the New Testament of a specific percentage set apart that a man needs to have a certain amount of support or even doing it this way. God just simply in the New Testament says appoint elders and deacons, and leaves it up to us to figure out the most expedient means in our time and place to do so. We do know from the New Testament, Acts chapter 6, that, for instance, the congregation could have a say when men were to be appointed among them for a public work, as happens in the case of Acts chapter 6, and those men set apart to serve the Hellenistic widows in the Jerusalem church. The congregation had a say, but exactly how, even in Acts chapter 6, how did the congregation have a say? The text isn't specific. Because God has left us, outside the general authority to appoint elders and deacons, God has left us no specific singular example. This is the way and the only way to do so. And so once again, we're left with a judgment call. The most expedient way to do it without violating any other principle of Scripture. And in our time, in our place, our elders have judged that basically looking for a man, especially in a congregation of this size, where we're never going to get 100% agreement on anything, if there's 400 of us, there's 500 opinions, you know how that works. The most expedient way to discern if a man has the consensus of the congregation support is look for a certain percentage of the congregation to basically support him as being appointed as a deacon. And that's simply an expedient. That's not because we have a specific passage in the Bible. We just have a general point made to us from the New Testament that we are to appoint elders and deacons, and God has left a discretion to us to determine what is the most expedient way in our time and our place to do so. And this is our elders' judgment about how best to do that here. And so hopefully, the time that we've spent together this morning, hopefully, if you were one of the people who put a question in the box, hopefully this gets to your concerns, your questions. If not, I know the elders are still open and happy to talk with you, as am I, about any questions or concerns that you may have. But this, at least in a relatively brief time, is our best effort this morning to address questions and concerns that have been raised about the nature of the work and about the process in which we are going about appointing them here. Before we conclude this morning, though, this has not been a typical sermon. This has not been a typical encouragement to live morally and righteously and godly. This has not been a typical sermon that talks about Jesus and how to be made right with God through him. But before we are through this morning, we do want to offer an invitation to anybody who may be here who's already familiar with what God asks and what God expects of you. You're already familiar with the gospel and its claim upon your life and what you need to do about it. Before we leave this morning, we'd like for you to have the opportunity, if you'd like to take it, to get your life right with God by confessing Jesus as Lord, Savior, Son of God, repenting of your sins, and being baptized for the forgiveness of those sins. Maybe you're here this morning, you're a child of God already. Maybe your conscience is beating on you this morning. And you know that your life is not right with God and maybe not even right with your brethren here. You have the opportunity this morning to come and talk to us about however you failed your God and maybe your brethren. We'll be happy to pray with you and for you and help you in whatever we can. But if you need to take advantage of this opportunity to get your life right with God this morning, we can help you in any way. Come talk to us right now while we stand and while we sing.